of driving up all kinds of costs, property tax hikes. Is it on? I don't have to yell anymore. Hello? Okay, thank you. Can you hear back there? In 2013, the Government Accounting Standards Board changed their rules, and the way that they account for public pension plans really made a significant effect on making the stating the unfunded liabilities in a different way, and in most cases, the effect was to increase the unfunded liability. Coupled with the announcements of credit rating agencies that downgrade states with high unfunded liabilities, the pressure for pension reform obviously is here, and we must deal with it in Minnesota. So the governor's proposal here is to help work with the Legislative Commission to come up with a plan to deal with the sustainability problems of the pension problem. So let me go to the high level here. We're going to here's what I want to cover tonight. We have just one slide on each one of these plans so we can go through this relatively quickly. The governor is recommending changes to the Minnesota state retirement system, the general plan, the correctional plan, and the state patrol plans. He's recommending funding changes and support for the Teachers Retirement Association, for the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association, and for the Public Employees Retirement Association Police and Fire Plan. Each set of these recommendations reflect the needs of each particular plan and include changes such as increased employee contributions, increased employer contributions, reductions of retiree COLAs, and other plan changes. The governor's recommendation also includes a reduction of the investment return assumption to 7.5% for all the plans. These recommendations of the governor also reflect the values and conclusions of the Blue Ribbon Panel, which I discussed last week, and the need to make a more accurate statement of the unfunded liability through an investment return change, and also supporting these sustainability packages. We've provided a breakout to the commission staff showing where all of the different agency funding is for the changes that we've proposed. But let me go, first of all, and deal with the governor's recommended change plans to the Minnesota State Retirement System Plan, the general plan. For the general plan, the governor is recommending that we have a COLA reduction from 2% to 1.5% beginning in January of 2018, and we remove triggers that would automatically increase COLAs in the future. He recommends that we increase the employee contributions, bless you, from 5.5% to 6% beginning in fiscal 2018. He recommends that we increase the employer contribution rates from 5.5% to 8% phased in over time. We would see a 1% increase in fiscal 18, and a 0.5% increase in fiscal 19, a 0.5% in fiscal 20, and a 0.5% in fiscal 21. The employer contribution would remain at 8% until the fund attains a funded ratio of 100%, at which time it would return to 7%. We would also support re-amortization of the payments on an unfunded liability from a 26-year period to a 30-year period. On the correctional plan, the governor recommends a COLA reduction from 2% to 1.5%, effective January 2018. And a removal of triggers that would automatically increase COLAs in the future. He recommends an increase in employee contributions from 9.1% to 9.6% effective in fiscal year 2018. He recommends increasing employer contribution rates from 12.85% to 18.85% phased in over 4 years. And the employer contribution would remain at 18.5% until the fund attains a funded ratio of 100%, at which time it would return to 14.4%. The reamortization payments on the unfunded liabilities would go from a 22-year period to a 30-year period. On the state patrol plan, the governor recommends removal of triggers that would automatically increase COLAs in the future. It would increase the employee contributions from 14.5% to 15.4%, effective phased in 0.5% increments from fiscal 18 to fiscal 20. He would increase the employer contribution rates from 21.6% to 30.1%, phased in again over time. And the employee contribution would remain at 30.1% and employer, I meant to say, until the fund attains a funded ratio of 100%, at which time it would return to 23.1%. It would also recommend re-amortization of the payments on unfunded liabilities from a 22-year period to a 30-year period. If we can go to the Public Employee Retirement Association for the fire, for the Police and Fire Fund, he would recommend a $4.5 million direct aid in fiscal 18 and fiscal 19, and then a $9 million annual direct aid in fiscal 20 and beyond. Now, the PARA plan also made other recommendations that don't affect the funding by the state of Minnesota, but the governor supports the funding changes approved by the PARA board, where they would remove triggers which automatically increase COLAs in the future, and they would recommend increasing the employer contributions of 16.2% to 17.7%. They would also increase employee contributions from 10.8% to 11.8%, and see a re-amortization period go from an 18-year period to a 30-year period. Moving to the Teachers Retirement Association, the governor is recommending a COLA reduction from 2% to 1% for 5 years beginning in fiscal 2018 and 1.5% thereafter, and a removal of triggers that would automatically increase COLAs in the future. The governor recommends an increase in the regular contribution rates from 7.5% to 9.5%, once again phased in over time. And the re-amortization payment would be on the unfunded liabilities from a 20-year period to a 30-year period. And for St. Paul Teachers Retirement Association, the governor is recommending removal of triggers that would automatically increase COLAs in the future, increase in employer contribution rates from 6.5% to 8.5%, once again phased in over time, and re-amortization payments of unfunded liabilities from a 26-year period to a 30-year period. Those are the proposed changes that we made. Now, I do want to make some general comments about why we made some of the recommendations that we did. The governor was unable to sort of fund all the plan's requests in full. So we were forced with looking at what available resources that we had, and we felt that the recommended changes that the governor is funding in his proposed budget, and we'll go through the numbers by the agency, we felt that would provide the best sustainability package that we could afford at this time. We recommended some phasing in times that were a little bit different than what the plans recommended. Once again, that was trying to figure out a way that we could afford to make this significant general fund contribution. The other thing that we did was we have located all the pension fund costs are in each agency budget. So as part of the packet that the commission has, it shows the individual agencies and where the commission, the pension fund changes reside. Each agency was asked to estimate their operating cost changes that they recommended for the next year. And that was based on what would it take to keep the same workforce in place that we have today for the next 2 years. That included salary changes. That included minute changes at the agency, minute charges for IT, lease charges, legal fee charges. And those were accumulated in one area. And the agencies will talk about those specifically. But we also asked each agency to compute what they thought the pension changes would mean for them individually for each agency. So once again, we have an individual agency computation of what they think the pension increase, contribution increase we recommend would mean to that particular agency. So at this particular point, all of the recommended funding changes by the governor are residing in each agency's budget under a pension commission adjustment. The only other thing I want to mention is that you will see that in the chart. I guess we should go ahead and go to the chart, Susan. We will see in the chart that some of the funding for 20 and 21 remained flat. Once again, the governor was able to, we were able to find significant resources in 2018 and 2019. And it's not that we don't think that these other sustainability packages should be sustained in the future. It's just that the 20 and 21 out years were difficult to find resources for, and we were unable to fund them fully in 20 and 21. The additions we make just stay flat for 20 and 21. So I actually would like Susan Earle, from MMB to walk through this chart and show you the changes and additions to the different funds.
Ms. Earle, welcome. State your name, please.
For the record, my name is Susan Earle. I'm a budget officer at MMB. Just to walk the commission through the chart, the first component of the table that you'll see is the addition to the school aid formula. These amounts will be added to the general education formula and distributed to districts based on their covered payroll each year and their increased employer obligations under the governor's budget proposal. And then funding in the formula will be capped at the amounts you see in the table at the governor's recommended amounts. The next line is state agency funding. These costs are included, as Commissioner Franz mentioned, in each agency's operating budget increase that was approved by the governor. And these costs in this table reflect only the general fund recommendation. We'll just note that many state employees are paid in funds other than the general fund, and those employer contributions would be paid out of the funds where those employees' salaries are paid and are not reflected in this chart. The last line is the direct aid. This is the component that the governor is recommending for Paris Police and Fire Plan of $4.5 million in fiscal 18 and 19 and $9 million of direct aid thereafter.
So, Madam Chair, by going through this chart, you see that the governor has proposed spending $99,832,000 in fiscal 18 and fiscal 19 and a little over $137 million in fiscal 20 and 21 in the general fund. As Susan Earle mentioned, the other all funds budget also need to be adjusted, but we're only showing the general fund effect right in this situation. For example, some of the other agencies, need fee increases for some of their special funds to operate. And if those fee increases are adopted or if there are revenue changes that are adopted, then that agency will be able to adjust those new resources for the non-general fund employees. But right now what you're seeing are just the general fund employees that we're trying to provide this benefit to.
Are there any questions, members, on this particular part? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have two questions for clarification, Commissioner Franz, if I could. On the first page, under the governor's recommendations, the governor recommendation includes a reduction in the investment rate of return assumption to 7.5%. Is, just for clarification, is that all plans into perpetuity or some of the plans we may be hearing later tonight want to do a temporary? Is the governor looking at 7.5% for all plans into perpetuity, or is there a bump?
Commissioner Franz.
Or bounce back?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, one of the things we really wanted to respect was the process that all the plans went through, both in terms of deciding what the right mix of employer contributions, employee contributions, and COLA changes were. But one of the things we felt really strongly about, and the Blue Ribbon panel supported that, was a reduction in to 7.5%. And that was also reflected in our discussions with rating agencies. And they actually are running the pro formas of Minnesota's unfunded liability based upon 7.5%. So they're looking at it in different ways. We recommended that all the plans go to 7.5%, and I know that the Teachers Retirement Association has a shorter period, a five-year period, I believe, on their recommendation. We would recommend that they stay in place until we come up with a better way of assessing what is the right number going forward and how should that be changed. But you're right. Right now, we've simply recommended they all come to 7.5% immediately, and then it's up to them how long they continue that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Franz, the second question I have has to do with contributions. All plans appear to be asked on the employer and employee side to make additional contributions, but on the TRA side, the governor is recommending that only the employer side increase the contribution, that there's nothing on the employee side. And for equity among the different pension groups, I'm just wondering how the governor is rationalizing that, if you could shed some light on that.
Commissioner Franz.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, we felt that it was beyond our capability, if you will, to recommend employee contributions. We believe that was the TRA as a plan needed to come forward with what they felt was the right mix of shared sacrifice. Certainly the governor believes in shared sacrifice from the employer, the employee, and the retiree, and the retirees. But I think that's something that the TRA folks will have to talk about in terms of why they felt it wasn't appropriate for them to recommend an employee change. We would be we would like to see an employee contribution change in that plan. We just didn't feel it was our we didn't want to make a recommendation that was inconsistent with what the board had done.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Franz.
Is there further questions? Commissioner Franz, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is on the TRA contribution from the general fund here. How will that be distributed to the school districts?
Commissioner Franz.
Madam Chair, Representative, good question. I'll let Ms. Earle answer that.
Ms. Earle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, it will be distributed based on each district's salary, and so, or their covered salary for the prior year, and then a factor will be applied according to the schedule of the contribution increases that the governor is recommending. And then according to the cap that's in the governor's recommendation. So that'll be the total amount to be distributed out to districts based on their covered payroll.
Representative Peason. I do know, Commissioner, so the direct aid is just the para, police, and fire? And why? Just police and fire?
Madam Chair, it is the only direct aid the governor's recommending is the police and fire. And even then, as I mentioned, even then we weren't able to meet their request, but we felt that that was the most beneficial way to deal with their unfunded liability was to make a direct aid contribution. So that was after we looked at their contribution plan and the fund and the number of people in it. So we felt that this was a way to get their to deal with their unfunded liability quickly.
Okay. Even though they weren't asking for it.
What's that?
They weren't asking for it.
Madam Chair, they were asking for it, yes.
They were asking for it, okay. And Commissioner, we sent you a list of questions last week that we got together with all the funds and came up with a list of questions, and I'm hoping that you can answer those. Please address the questions. We don't have them in front of us, so you have.
Madam Chair, I'd be glad to do that. One of the first questions was the breakdown by agency, and we've provided that schedule to the Commission. One of the other ones was why we did not assume a payroll increase in the future fiscal years. This goes to the calculation of operating adjustments. So each agency was, as I mentioned, was requested to compute their operating adjustment for the next 2 years. And what we did with the pensions was we didn't want to build that on top of those projections. We wanted the operating adjustments by the agencies to be calculated based on what those needs were for salary, insurance, IT rates, lease, and legal. But we wanted the increase for the recommended pension changes to be based on what the 2017 salaries were. So we wanted to keep that pension adjustment focused on that. So that's why we did not increase salaries for the pension adjustment. One of the other questions was why we didn't support employee contributions, as Mr. Vice Chair asked about, and as I mentioned, we didn't. We recognize their decision to not make that recommendation to us. One of the other questions was why did the governor phase in the employer contribution differently than the phase-in proposed by some of the plans? This was once again based on available resources. We believe that the contribution amounts and the percentages that the plans put forward made sense and were needed, but we simply didn't have the resources to meet it under the phase-in that they had proposed. So we stretched out the phase-in a little bit simply to make it more affordable for the current budget. One of the questions is, what is the advantage of phasing in the employer increase? It allows, one of the things we wanted to do was to make sure that the agencies actually have the money to pay for these pension increases. Sometimes if there's not enough funds, if there's no funds appropriated to the agencies, it just comes out of their operating budget. So one of the reasons we wanted to phase in a little bit slower the employer contribution rates was to give the agencies sufficient funding to make sure that happened. Another question was about as you mentioned, the question about the police and fire, and the full aid request from the police and fire was for a full $9 million each year, but we were unable to meet that budget, but we did believe that they were in need of at least $4.5 million per year and then $9 million in 20 and 21. There was a question about why the St. Paul teachers did not get the same direct aid, or any direct aid. The governor's plan obviously included contribution supports, employer contribution supports to St. Paul teachers, just like the Teachers Retirement Association. But we believe that this is just a first step, and we would like to see the St. Paul Teachers Plan do a little bit more work on their shared contributions before we make any direct contributions to their plan. So that was why we did not make a direct contribution. And there was a question about the timing of the phase-in of the contribution rates. I'm sorry, is this for the para?
Yep.
Oh, so one of the reasons we did not make any recommendations on the para also made some recommendations for their plan about phasing and contribution levels, but since we don't in the state government fund those directly, we did not make any comment on their funding recommendations. We support their plan, but we don't actually fund it, so we didn't feel it was appropriate to recommend one way or the other, even though we do support it. There is a question about why, especially for TRA, going from 8.5% to 7.5% on the investment return is a significant financial change. And how did we evaluate the impact of reducing the return on investment rate to 7.5%, especially for TRA? Well, the governor and we looked at all the different proposals brought by the plans, and we believe that it was important that all the plans adopt 7.5% a discount rate or a return rate, and so that we knew that that was going to cause some plans more pain, if you will, than others. But we felt that based on the way that the rating agencies were reviewing our unfunded liability, we felt that it was important that all the plans take that same step. So we do understand it created additional unfunded liability for every plan, and that's why the governor was supporting a direct investment in increasing contributions by the state agencies or increasing aid to the schools through the school aid pension proposal. So we do believe that it did create additional liability, but we do believe we've provided some support in increasing the contributions to TRA. And
Commissioner,
yes.
We have a question. Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner. So the slide that's up there right now, so, and again, I don't have any numbers going back because I'm new on the board, but so for fiscal years 18 and 19, we're basically contributing $100 million, and in fiscal year 20 and 21, we're contributing $137 million. If you went back 2 years and 4 years, is this normal average? Is it more than, or just kind of can comment on how it falls within the normal?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, well, this is additional contribution, so I think it's important to remember this is above and beyond what is currently being contributed by the state. And so, maybe Ms. Earle has that in front of her. I don't recall the recent history, but Minnesota's been quite good about staying on top of these and making changes to the contribution levels over the last several years, and that's why one of the reasons why we don't have such an enormous unfunded liability compared to the assets that we have. But we'll get that for you so you can have something to compare it to.
Thank you. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, underneath the TV, I see you. I just want to thank you for working on this and for coming in with recommendations. I believe it's the first time since I've been on the commission that the governor has ever and his administration has ever engaged in pensions at an early point and made recommendations to us. And it's really an important area of state government. So thank you for being engaged and presenting today.
Senator Pappas, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's very important to have the governor at the table right from the very beginning with this discussion because we are in the work of making some changes with collaboration of everybody in this room and beyond, but the governor's a very important part of this. Commissioner, still have a few more?
Madam Chair, I do have a few more. There was a question about the different treatment of TRA versus St. Paul teachers. The TRA received all the contributions it requested, but the St. Paul teachers did not. Once again, the governor's recommendation was to step in as much as we could on all the pension plans and provide some support. But I guess our concern was that there was some more work to be done in the St. Paul teachers' retirement fund to get it more of an equitable shared sacrifice issue. So we limited our contribution under that reasoning. What's the rationale behind imposing a dollar cap on the amount of aid? Well, that's a good question. one of the reasons is this keeps the cost of the plan within available resources. And one of the things we wanted to do was avoid growing these obligations beyond what we had allocated or beyond the money that we have. So the increases we propose are meant to offset very specific costs that are approved in the budget, not just overall future pension increases. I think that's what this legislative commission is responsible in large part for overseeing that and working to make sure that these changes are made as necessary periodically. We all know that this is not a fix, that you don't, for once and for all, solve these problems. These are ongoing issues that we have to manage together. And so I think one of the things we wanted to do was to make sure that to the extent the governor can allocate some general fund money and all fund money to this problem, that we do so with foresight and knowing what we want to do so that we don't just say let it grow without any oversight. I don't think I have any other questions.
Ms. Earle,
happy to take more.
Oh, good. Ms. Earle, do you have any comments?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any questions from members? Did a pretty good job on these questions.
Madam Chair, and I want to congratulate your staff and working with us. This is a new thing for MMB too to be involved at this early in the process and working with this commission on the budget side of this. As you work on the commission side and figure out what the right things are to do, you're going to be hearing a lot of testimony from a lot of smart people who have done a great job in running these plans. And Minnesota, I think, should be really proud of where we are, and the opportunity here to make these changes is so critical for us. So I really look forward to working with the commission. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. Look forward to working with you all, too, very much. Thank you very much. With that, we are going to go into the plans, and we have Ms. Erin Leonard with MSRS, the Executive Director. I think, members, if you don't mind, we'll have all the plans come up and give their proposal. And I think by that time, it'll be about 7 o'clock. We could probably entertain a few questions, but I'd like to keep it till 7 o'clock if I could. Thank you. Ms. Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Erin Leonard. I'm the new executive director at MSRS. Some of you may remember Dave Bergstrom. He retired in December, and I'm his successor. So somewhat new to the job, but I've been with MSRS for 13 years. I do have a cold, so I apologize.
I was going to say, could you speak up?
Yeah.
It sounds like you can't.
So I will try my very best.
Okay.
So just to provide a little bit of background about MSRS, we do administer 5 defined benefit pension plans for state employees. Our largest is the General Employees Retirement Plan. We also administer a Correctional Employees Retirement Plan that covers correctional officers who are working in the facilities or security hospitals and working directly with inmates or offenders or patients. And we have a State Patrol Plan and a Judges Plan, and then our Constitutional Officers and Legislators Plan. For the proposals going forward in 2017, we're only addressing our 3 largest plans. We've had other reforms in our judges' plan more recently. We also administer 3 defined contribution plans. We have an unclassified retirement plan that is available to elected officials, legislative staffers, and others. We have a deferred compensation plan, and Susan mentioned this last week, but it is the 5th largest plan in the United States. We have just over $6 billion in that plan and about 85,000 participants. And then we are unique in that we offer a healthcare savings plan. It is the largest in the country. We have over 100,000 participants, $800 million. And this allows individuals who are working to save for healthcare expenses in retirement. So they put a little aside while they're working on a tax-free basis, and it allows for them to reimburse that later on. So for today's conversation, we're going to focus on our general correctional and state patrol plans. As you're aware, we have about $11.2 billion in our general plan. In total for these 3 plans, we have about $12.7 billion in assets as of July 1. We do have an unfunded liability in each plan, and that totals about $3.7 billion, so that we do have some unfunded liabilities that need to be addressed. Our funded ratios in these plans on a market value are 78.4%, 68.5%, and 75.6%. I won't go through all these numbers, but we do have deficiencies in all the plans, and which is why we're moving forward with a 2017 proposal this year. The next slide, slide five, just provides a little context as to where we've come. As we've been meeting with legislators, some of them have asked, have you ever been 100% funded? And the answer is yes. And not too long ago, we were very close to 100% funded in our general plan. In 2006, we were 98% funded on a market value basis. You all know that the Great Recession happened, and that really impacted these plans greatly. And then we started to progress fairly well back into the positive territory, over 90% funded. And you've heard about the COLA triggers and reducing those, and we actually almost triggered those COLA triggers to 2.5%, but then changed the law, so we had to be 90% for 2 years. Then we're facing new challenges. People are living longer, which is a great thing for individuals, but as a pension plan, it's a little more challenging. And then, so life expectancy, and then we've also lowered our assumed rate of return from 8.5 to 8 over the last few years. So those both increase liabilities to the pension plans. I'm going to skip slide 6 because Mansko went through that very well. And then I'm going to skip slide 7 as well. So the board did come together for a special meeting in October to develop proposals for this session to address the unfunded liabilities with our plans. These proposals all include going to a 7.5 assumed rate of return. They all include employee contributions and employer contributions, and in some cases they include a cost of living adjustment change for retirees. In addition, they all include some actuarial assumption changes from combined service factor load, as well as a reamortization of the unfunded liability. So the big question is why lower the rate of return assumption? So there's a few reasons our board decided to address this issue, even though it immediately increases our liabilities by $931 million. The State Board of Investment, you heard, had an investment liability study completed in May, and the 10-year median return was 7.3 according to that study. In addition, we see national trends heading this direction. So if you look at other public pension plans throughout the country, they are 8% is an outlier, and they are moving towards the median of 7.5%. And then our actuary, every year when they prepare our actuarial valuations, they actually look at a range of reasonableness for rates of return. And 8% was at the high end of the range of reasonableness, and they did make a note in our actuarial valuations that perhaps this next year that wouldn't be within the range and that it may be prudent to go to a lower investment assumption. So based on all that information, our board decided to move forward with the proposal to go to 7.5. The next slide on slide 10 just shows where we're headed if we just go to 7.5 and don't address any other funding issues or benefit changes. And those dotted lines are heading in the wrong direction. So they did get together to come up with a proposal. For the general employees retirement plan, it's very similar to what the commissioner just mentioned related to the governor's recommendations. A reamortization to a new 30-year period, a reduction of the cost of living adjustment to 1.5% for retirees. This immediately reduces our unfunded liability by $711 million, so it is a significant cost reduction. To remove the COLA triggers at this point, our projections don't show we're going to reach that 90% funding, so there is a minimal impact, but long-term, it just shows that they won't get to that 2.5% COLA. For employees, we're proposing a 0.5% increase, this starting in July 1, fiscal year 18, and then a 1.5% employer increase for the employer side, and then in fiscal year 2020, an additional 1%. This is the first time that the general plan we've always had equal employee and employer contributions. Part of the reason that the board proposed going to a higher employer contribution was because these additional liabilities from both the mortality changes as well as the 7.5 rate of return assumption impact the liabilities on retirees today, not just the active employees. And so the employer is picking up more of that cost. For a correctional employees retirement plan, again, a reamortization to a new 30-year period, a reduction to a cost of living adjustment to 1.5. This immediately reduces the liabilities in that plan by $76 million. This is a smaller plan, so the impact is not as great, but it still adds up. Removing the COLA triggers, increasing the employer contribution to 14.4%, which is a 1.55% increase, increasing the employee contribution by 0.5%, and then adding a state supplemental contribution of 4.45%. This is actually, it sounds a lot as far as a percentage goes, but it's about $11.2 million per year to this plan. Once this plan reaches 100% funded, that supplemental contribution would be the first thing to be reduced. Then our State Patrol plan. This is a small plan. It covers our State Patrol, State Troopers, our BCA agents, DNR conservation officers, peace officers in the state. And this is unique in that it has a higher retiree liability than active liability. And when markets are down, this plan really is impacted in a poor way. But when markets rebound, they rebound much quicker. So the proposal for this plan is a little different. We still proposing to do the reamortization, remove the triggers, an employee contribution phased in 1%, 0.5% in fiscal year 18 and 0.5% in fiscal year 2020, an employer contribution of 0.75%, that same phase-in schedule, an additional 7% of pay, which is the equivalent of about $5 million per year for this plan. We are not proposing a COLA reduction in this plan, because they are currently at 1% already, and this plan, as many of you are aware, is not coordinated with Social Security, and so they are more vulnerable to Social Security or to inflation in retirement. So the proposal, if adopted, the last slide just shows where the lines are headed. All of our plans are heading toward 100% funded. Our correctional plan actually exceeds 100% funded within the 30-year amortization period.
Burning questions. Representative Anderson, I know I said no questions, but we will let
Sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Nope. Well, I'm just trying to keep it under our time, but since we have her, go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you
Thank you very much,
Ms. Leonard. And then we have Mr. Doug Anderson with the PARA, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commission members, I'm Doug Anderson, Executive Director of PERA. And I'd like to talk about our five plans. We have five plans that represent employees of over 2,300 employers. General Employees Plan is our largest by number of participants. Generally, these are not career employees. We have a lot of people who have started employment with these local employers, but have not currently employed. So we have a lot of members in deferred payment status. And typically, the employees do not spend an entire career with PARA. So you see an average age of 47, but average years of service, 10 years. Our police and fire plan, I would just point out, is that it's a more mature plan. The number of retirees compared to active members is really pretty close, makes the plan pretty sensitive to some changes, as we'll talk about. And our correctional plan is noteworthy for being a relatively newer plan and having a lot of active members per retiree, so new and growing. On page 3, it talks a little bit about the cash flow and the investment returns for the year. So these are the current contribution rates. Representing the money coming into the plan, the current payroll, so we can see the contributions coming in and the benefit payments out. So again, with the general employees plan, we see a negative net cash flow, benefits out larger than contributions in. Similar with police and fire, and with the correctional plan, it's actually a growing plan where contributions are coming in before more than benefit payments. So with these mature plans, you can see the importance of having a plan well-funded, and the importance of high investment returns, and we didn't recognize that in fiscal year 16, seeing actually some very small losses in the plan. Last week you saw a picture a lot like this, which talks about the process of turning assets and liabilities into annual funding. And so I'd like to spend more of the time with our police and fire plan, because that's where we have a proposal for changes. The participant data, assumptions, and methods were made. And plan provisions were all interpreted to create a present value of benefits. The amount of present value of benefits that's attributable to past service is called the accrued liability, and we compare the actuarial value of assets to that accrued liability. That results in the funding ratio. We see that as 88%, leaving an unfunded liability of $1 billion. When that unfunded liability is amortized and combined with the cost of benefit accruals, that creates the required contribution. And I do have these two numbers on the bottom right reversed. The numbers are correct. They're just reversed. So the amortization payment results in 7.6% of payroll. Normal cost is 20.7% of payroll. So it's a required contribution of 28.3% compared to the actual contributions coming in of 29.5%. Now, this is the valuation results, and it would be nice to be able to stop the story there because it's favorable. It shows a funding sufficiency. But one thing we knew at this time was that there's actually a lot of assumption changes to be made for this plan. And those assumption changes came in four different categories. There was work that was done by the actuary to look at 5 years of demographic data and result in a recommendation of a lot of different changes about mortality rates, future mortality improvements, retirement rates, disability rates, and so forth. And that had an impact of $153 million liability increase. Then the LCPR actuary did a study about combined service. And there was a small adjustment to this plan to increase liability to for that assumption change. And then in the bottom right, our board is also proposing reflecting an update to the Society of Actuaries table for mortality improvements. This actually first came out in the experience studies, where there's a table in 2014 that tried to predict the rates of future improvement in mortality. And then in 2015, the Society of Actuaries updated that model, and in 2016, they updated it again. So when the model first came out in 2014, it was a large contributing cause to the liability increase because the model predicted that while we could estimate current mortality rates very closely, the model was saying that the rates of future improvement means that we're expecting our employees to live 2 years longer. And with these adjustments, they now have put a few more years into that model, adjusted the model a little bit, and they've scaled back that optimism about future improvement. So with the change, as our board's proposing, to use the 2016 model, that would actually have a liability decrease. So all of these factors went into the board's consideration of the assumption changes. And since Aaron talked about the investment setting a process, I won't repeat what she said because we have the same actuary and we have the same asset allocation. What I will note here is the chart on the bottom right, which is that with the board's recommendation to go from 8% to 7.5%, it's consistent with a trend. This is a survey of results showing a long 15-year trend of moving towards a more conservative assumption. And a change from 8% would move this plan from the dark blue on the top right of those that are using 8% to the more conservative half of those in the survey. So summarizing the results, after reflecting, comparing the first set of valuation results with the results after the assumption changes, the net impact was about $0.5 billion of liability increase, which means the same unfunded liability increase amount, reduces the funding ratio, and it pushes the projection of the COLA trigger out to a point where it wouldn't happen. In fact, the projection, if these new recommended assumptions are met, is that the funded status would actually decline, and not only would the trigger not happen, there'd have to be some change to be moving this plan in a positive direction. So in terms of funding deficiency, it changed the funding deficiency from 0.9% deficient to 4.2% deficient. So the board proposed some changes after consulting with stakeholder groups, first to extend the amortization period, then to eliminate the 2.5% trigger. And since the projection was that the plan's funded status would not increase, it means there's no projection that the trigger would actually occur. That's why there's no cost associated with that. Now, that's the actuarial interpretation. In reality, there could be a cost because assumptions aren't always met, and the plan could achieve something better. So that was viewed as a concession by the retiree group. Then the contribution increases were proposed are 1% for employees, phased in over 2 years, and 1.5% for employers. I would add that the board did understand that stakeholders may ask for additional support, and they supported accepting that money if those stakeholders were successful. And recognizing that there is some money in the current governor's budget, all of this is reflected on the chart where I was looking. The red line here is showing, with all the proposed assumption changes, that the funded status actually would be projected to improve just slightly, but then start to decline. With the proposed changes, it doesn't immediately impact the fund, but the cumulative effect of ongoing contributions going forward would put it back on the path towards 90% funded, or including the proposed state aid, up to 93% funded in a 30-year period. We're not proposing changes to the general plan, but just given its size, we do want to address it very briefly. Here, too, this plan went through a lot of changes on the assumptions. The demographic changes were all incorporated into the 2016 valuation results already. The changes that are additional changes that are proposed include the combined service load, which was very significant for this plan. Is actually very positive. The change in the assumption resulted in a close to an $800 million liability decrease. And that is very effective in helping to offset the impact of lowering the assumption from 8% to 7.5%. And here, too, our board is proposing to use the new Society of Actuaries table for mortality improvements. So compared to the 2016 valuation, reflecting the net impact of all the different assumption changes, the net impact is a much relatively smaller increase in the liability and the unfunded liability, and a slight decrease in the funded ratio. It does push off the expected 2.5% trigger date quite a few years in the future, and does increase the funding deficiency. And the chart on the following page just shows the impact of the valuation result and the trajectory of the funding growth versus after the assumption changes. So the net impact really wasn't that great. The board looked at this and seeing that if all the assumptions, even the more conservative investment and demographic assumptions are met, the funded status would be improving. The board did not propose any changes for this plan. And would just like to add one final word on sensitivity of results. So while the plan shows a 3.5% deficiency, that's measured on a 17-year amortization period, relatively shorter period of time. If it were measured on a 30-year amortization period, it's only a 0.5% deficiency. Sometimes we use actuarial value instead of market value. Actually, if it was measured on the actuarial value in a 30-year period, it'd be a 0.2% sufficiency. And what that means at actuarial value is that even if there were a small gain to this plan, it would be on path for being closer to be fully amortized in that 30-year period. And again, with the more conservative assumptions, it just positions the plan better to have larger gains in positive years and smaller losses in negative years.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
Any burning question? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it, Mr. Anderson. And now we have Ms. Hacking with TRA.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Laurie Hacking, Teachers Retirement Association, and my colleague Jay Stoffel will also be joining me.
Welcome. Thank you.
There's a handout, I believe, in front of you, and in the interest of time, since we've been able to meet with nearly all the commission members, we won't go through all of that. There's some background slides about how pensions are important to teacher recruitment and retention that I would suggest that would be of interest to you and the revenue sources of the plan. So we're going to go straight to slide six. to go over the elements of the proposal, and I'd like to say in advance we're going to spend some time talking about the 7.5 investment return assumption and why that is very inadvisable, we believe, for TRA at this time. It creates a very, very large funding gap for us all at once, and we do not believe that fiscally and politically it's possible to fill that gap all at once. That is why we are proposing a more phased approach to that, and Jay is going to talk in more detail about that. So on page 6 is our proposal, the elements of it, and I want to stress the board worked with all of our stakeholder groups, retirees, active employees, employers, to come to an agreement on this proposal, and they are endorsing it. And we believe it's a balanced proposal. The pie chart on the right-hand side of this page shows you how each stakeholder group bears, what portion they bear of the solution, and it is fairly evenly distributed. So the cuts that we're proposing in COLAs are deeper than what we had before you last year. They're bigger cuts, would reduce it from 2% to 1% for 5 years and then down to 1.5 thereafter, and eliminating all the future COLA triggers that have been discussed. Active teachers would see the same reduction in their COLA in the future. All of that amounts to over 2.66% of pay savings. That's about $1.5 billion reduction in liabilities. Just for perspective, last year the proposal before you would have reduced liabilities by $1 billion. So it's quite a significant increase in the cut that we are proposing. On the employer side, we're recommending a 2% contribution increase from 7.5 to 9.5, but given that that's a large increase, last year we had only proposed a 1% increase. We would propose to phase this over 4 years gradually at 0.5% per year, and very important that it be offset by pension aid through the pension adjustment mechanism in the school aid formula. And this aspect of this pension aid offset is very important to our employer groups and critical to having their support for this package going forward. On the next page, There have been questions about the governor's package, and so we thought I know there's a lot of numbers on this page, but lay out specifically how it would work, how the costs are expected for school districts and charter schools, and how that compares to what the governor is proposing. So you see that we're phasing in the increase, 8% up to 9.5%. 7.5 we're starting at, but going up to 9.5. The next column shows you the cost specifically for school districts and charter schools, which represents over 95% of our payroll. We have some Minsky and other employers in the mix here, but this is just for school districts and charters that we're showing. So you see each year what the cost would be for them. That first column is assuming there's no payroll growth, which we understand was the assumption behind the governor's proposal. We were asked by staff, and we agreed to show, well, what if we do see payroll growth? So the next column is assuming a 2.5% per year payroll growth. That's probably on the high side, meaning higher than what we will actually experience, but at least this gives you a range of the potential costs. And then the next column shows the aid that is provided in the governor's proposal, just what would be for TRA. And then the last column shows that there is a relatively slight shortage in the first 2 years, meaning the governor's proposal would cover most, 90% or more of the costs. But in the last 2 years, the gap grows because, as Commissioner Franz explained, they would propose to cap the aid coming through the pension aid adjustment. So that is an area of concern, and we would understand we'd have to be coming back to request additional aid to cover the contribution increases that are expected in the third and fourth year. In addition, the other elements of our package are to extend the amortization period to 30 years, which we think is appropriate given the nature of these liabilities that are due to mortality improvements and investment returns, which is a future liability issue. And then also requiring employer contributions on salaries for reemployed annuitants. So turning to the next page, 8, are displayed the actual component savings of our proposal. The COLA cuts, which represent the largest portion of the package, again, saves 2.66% of pay. That's $120 million per year. Contribution increase, once it's fully phased in by the fourth year, would be $90 million a year. Amortization has a smaller reduction of $49 million per year, which brings the total package to 5.74% of pay. That's the savings, or $259 million annually. We would still have somewhat of a deficiency remaining, not a huge one, but 0.42% of pay. So it gets us most of the way to what we need in terms of savings. The next page is just graphically shows the projection of funded ratio with the proposal, without the proposal. Without it, we would be heading in negative territory, which is not good, and that's why we need some changes. And with the proposal, we would be headed to 89%. Again, not all the way to 100, but close to it. So with that, we're going to talk about the 7.5% issue because we know it's significant. And I just want to reiterate that for TRA, this change, if it were to come into effect, to 7.5 is really pretty draconian, very serious effect on our finances. And I'm going to let Jay go through the information about that.
Welcome, Ms. Stofter.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. I get the non-controversial part of the presentation here. Starting on page 10, I'm going to cover page 10 and 11. This is really all about, as Lori said, the investment return assumption. Currently, the TRA is at 8.5%. We had an experience study that was delivered in 2015 that recommended that we change from an 8.5% assumption long-term to 8% long-term. And we attempted that last year, but it was in the pension bill that was vetoed by the governor. So today, as we sit here, we are still using an 8.5% return assumption. So what the board supports is to make a change is to do a data-driven study of not just the investment return assumption, but all of our actuarial assumptions, our economic assumptions. The investment return assumption is probably one of the most powerful assumption that we use. It makes a big difference whenever we change it. The other important thing to note is that it works very closely in relation with the other economic assumptions that we use, like salary, inflation, and all those sort of things. So to change one at one point in time without looking at all the others, it's kind of a disjointed way of proceeding along with our normal routine of doing experience studies every 4 years, looking out over a 60-year time period, which is really our time horizon, and then making some changes that make sense of all of our actuarial assumptions taken as a set on a very comprehensive basis. So what the TRA board is acknowledging is 7.5% is sounds like it's getting a lot of interest. So our proposal recommends going to 7.5% for a 5-year period of time and then reverting back to the 8% long term. And in the meantime, during that 5-year temporary or transitional period, do a couple of things. Number one, another experience study is going to be delivered in about 2 years. That's our normal 4-year cycle. We look at all of our assumptions again on a holistic basis. That will be delivered 2 years from now, and we'll make some sense of things at that time. And it's, again, during this interim period. The other thing that gives us time to do is really look around the country. This is something that all the pension funds around the country are dealing with, struggling with, agonizing over, and it's a very difficult and complicated issue and a very important one. And what we'd like to do is take the time and help the legislature maybe consider other alternative methods for setting the rate and rather than just coming up with an opinion-based or maybe looking at average or what the popular number is. Looking at something that's a little bit more maybe best practice related, what are things that what are ways the other systems around the country are approaching this task? We've done some preliminary research on what goes on, how California sets their rate. Mississippi does some interesting things, Kansas. So I think with more time, we can come up with some alternative ways, maybe better ways of approaching this and come up with a good systematic, sort of a logical financial way to approach this, rather than just asking the question, well, what do you think, and come up with something that's maybe popular or average. So that's what the temporary period would give us time to do. It's also nothing real new. Back in 2012, when Maury Lanning was chair of the Pension Commission, we took this exact same approach back then. The question was asked about investment returns. Seemed like returns were kind of coming down. The expectations were coming down at that time. So the decision and the agreement at that time was to reduce the assumption from 8.5% to 8% for 5 years and then go back to 8.5%. We're taking that same model and adjusting again by 5 percentage points for half a percent for 5 years, and then reverting. And again, in the meantime, doing those two studies. So the other really important thing I'd like you to kind of keep in mind is that for TRA, for all the pension funds, as I said, this is a very important assumption, and it's a long-term assumption. The way we define long-term is 60, 70 years. So to make a change is really important, and there's, I think, different ways of bringing information into the equation to help us determine what that rate should be. You have heard from previous testifiers that the State Board of Investment did a study and with their consultant is recommending is a 7.3% for the next 10 years, given their asset allocation, their portfolio. Well, that's an important input for us. We acknowledge that that's good information. That's right from Wall Street. That's right from the professionals at the State Board of Investment. We like that information, but it's only 10 years. What about the other 50, 60 years that comprises our time horizon? That, again, gets to how can we study this through our actuarial firm where they're looking at a 60-year time horizon. What are the other funds around the country doing to approach this task of looking at a 60-year time horizon? Wall Street will not give us a 60-year number or even a 20-year number or a 15 number. They will provide a 10-year number, good information, an important input, but not complete for us. Moving from 8.5% to 7.5% is dramatic. It adds $3.2 billion in liabilities to our balance sheet and increases our deficiency just by that alone, that change alone, by 5.8% of payroll. So, and even with our package, if we change if we're successful in getting our proposal passed through the legislature this year with the benefit cuts and the contribution rate increases, if we were left with a 7.5% investment return assumption, we would still be short by almost 3% of pay, which is another $100 million on top of what we're proposing in our proposal currently. So it's another $100 million that we're just short. So making the change to the assumption without financing, without funding it, is a risky thing to do. It doesn't help the fund. It hurts the fund without putting the financing behind it, without the funding. So what we're suggesting is let's set the rate at 7.5, or have a goal of setting the rate at 7.5 sometime in the future. Let's work towards that goal. Let's try to get there in a period of time. And along the way, as we make adjustments, maybe they could be measured, careful adjustments along the way, fund them as we go along. But to do it in all in one fell swoop is, without the funding, is harmful to the fund and really difficult to absorb. The other funds have ways to absorb it that TRA does not. So we're just not in the same position, given our demographics, our other assumptions, and so forth. We just can't absorb it the way the other plans can. So the numbers behind this on page 11, I'll quickly go through the numbers. As I mentioned, the accrued liability increases by $1 billion to go from what we're suggesting, the 7.5% for 5 years and then 8% to a flat 7.5%. That adds over $1 billion to our liabilities. Our current funding ratio is 74.3 under our proposal. It would drop to 71.4. Our projected funding ratio under our program would get us on a track to be 89% funded over a 30-year period and basically would be flatlined at 7.5% if that were the assumption that we were to use. And you can see our contribution deficiency numbers ramp up pretty seriously by going to 7.5% without the funding behind it. So, again, we're concerned about the increased risk to the TRA plan by just making the change without the funding that would come that's needed behind it. I think we would, with those kind of contribution deficiencies, have to be talking about higher contribution rate increases or benefit reductions of equivalent value. And at that point, that's where we start losing the support of our stakeholder groups that we've been able to garnish at this point with our proposal going forward. So I think with that, I don't think we're going to go through the rest of our handout, but that's our presentation for tonight.
I'm going to break my rule of thumb here and ask a question, because you made a comment that the other plans can absorb it and TRA can't. Could you explain that further?
Well, there is one thing. There's something that, especially in the case of PERA, they have. We've all studied our combined service load. I think we've talked to several of you, of the members, about the combined service study that was done recently. The first time we implemented a combined service load was 15 years ago. What that does is acknowledge that we all have combined service members in our plans. They're earning benefits in another plan that affects the benefit from our plan. So we need to acknowledge that additional cost in our plan. So 15 years ago, there was it was called a combined service load that we all established, and we have been using ever since that date. Recently, we reevaluated those load factors and found out that in some funds, it's very high, enormously high. In TRA's case, it's pretty much on target. We're making a few changes. But the changes that we're making are very small compared to what some of the other funds are experiencing. So that is one way that, and it's quite significant, especially in the case of PERA, where there's a significant savings to them to change their CSA load factors, and TRA just doesn't have that experience.
Any other burning questions? Good. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. I mean, kind of building on that, so I just don't get how it harms the fund, because the money is the money. So it looks worse.
Right.
Right, that's what you're saying. It's not, I mean, it's going to be the same amount of money that's going to be available to people. It just looks worse.
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, yeah, it does look worse, but it's the condition of the plan. It's real. I mean, it's the financing that's going into the plan that's not flowing from an assumption change.
And if I may, I just add to that. I think our approach has been, when we've had to make these changes, we've meeting assumption changes that are significant, or when we've had to like compensate for asset loss, as we did in 2008, 2009, that we come forward with a plan that still balances the system going forward. And we are just not able to do that if right now to go to 7.5. And that's why we are proposing a more phased approach to give us more time and to look at alternative investment assumption methods. So I think it just to implement this and then leave a very, very large gap, which I think is going to be the result, we feel is just not a good way of taking care of our pension system. So we, in the past, like I said, have been tried to be orderly, understand the assumption changes, build a package that responds to that. And that's just very difficult right now, because it's a huge change for us to make in 1 year. We're still swallowing going from 8.5 to 8, let alone down from 8 to 7.5. So I think that's really, it's more the orderly process and taking care of this problem as it comes onto our books.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one other thing. If the other way to look at things, the best position to be in is overfunded. And in that case, we can weather market downturns and other things that might happen. Here we're saying if we flatline at 70%, that just takes away the opportunity, the ability to weather anything that might come along as far as another market downturn or, again, maybe possibly in the future extending mortality adjustments, those sort of things. So it's the opposite of where we'd like to be. 100% or 110% funded allows us to weather and to manage those kinds of events.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. All true. And I, you know, if we need to put more money in, we should do that. But that's all. I mean, that's all the case, even if you're at 7.5%, or if you're at 8%, but the returns come in less, you're going to be facing that same thing. What are the other plans, if staff can help, what is MSRS and PERA at right now in terms of their investment assumption?
Ms. Lincheski.
All the plans are at 8% right now. They're proposing to go down to 7.5%.
except TRA,
TRA
is
at 8.5% right now.
Right. So, and that was, sorry, Madam Chair. So, and that was because we went down to 8 and then only TRA bounced back up?
No, yeah, Ms. Lancheski, but that's correct. They chose a select and ultimate.
And just to clarify, we were planning to go to 8. That was in last year's bill, but it got vetoed.
That's right, Ms. Hacking.
So, Madam Chair, so we never went down to 8.5 for TRA?
I'm sorry, what was that question?
We never went down to 8 for TRA?
No.
That's correct.
No, okay. We have not. No, no.
All right. So when,
but Representative Thiessen, that in 2012, they did choose to go to select and ultimate when everybody else went down to 8%. They went back up to 8.5. Is that correct?
Not exactly. I think everyone was in the select and ultimate, all right. Three systems. Not sure about St. Paul, but I believe we were all doing that select and ultimate. And then the other system
chose... But you had the five-year... with the experience study.
Right. We were all waiting till the experience study was completed and then adjusting our investment assumption, which the other two systems were just 1 year ahead of us in wanting to do that, and we followed them last year, except the bill got vetoed.
Representative Thiessen.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the if you're already at 8%, if you were already at 8%, then the 0.5% reduction, I mean, had we done this, had you followed all the other plans previously, then you'd be also in a different position now to go down to 7.5%, perhaps, right?
Ms. Hacking.
Representative Thiessen, Madam Chair, the bottom line is that the movement from 8.5 to 7.5 is huge financially.
But Madam Chair, that's the choice they had already made previously. That's the point I'm making, to stay at 8.5%. So I just don't know why if we go to 7.5% or 8%, it looks different on paper, but the dollars are the same. And I just don't understand why we wouldn't acknowledge the fact that maybe the plan is not in as good a shape as it should be, and that gives you the better case to come back here and actually ask for more help. To get to the reality of what we need to get to. And so I don't know why we're ignoring reality.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, you're correct in your analysis, absolutely. It's a matter of what we can bring to you with the support of our stakeholder groups at this point in time and with the funding. And that's the funding, as you've heard from the governor's staff, is just partway of what we're needing. And that's, that's really the bottom line. Okay. Is what can be afforded and what can be tolerated all at once by our stakeholder groups.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, yes. Mr. Stoffel, Ms. Hackey. And Ms. Schertz with St. Paul Teachers, please. Welcome, Ms. Schertz. Please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. My name is Jill Schertz. I'm the Executive Director of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. Thank you for having us here tonight. I think we're otherwise known as the small plan that needs to work harder, so let us get started on that hard work.
The little engine that could.
I'll just spend a second for those that we haven't met with yet or presented for talking about the background of the fund. We have been providing pension benefits to the teachers of St. Paul for 107 years now. Like the others, we're governed by a board of trustees, one ex officio member from our district, and nine members representing active and retired teachers of the district. Obviously, we're subject to oversight here by the legislature and the LCPR. We're also annually audited by the Office of the State Auditor. And we enjoy the benefits of a nationally recognized actuarial firm that we share in common with MSRS and PARA. That's Gabriel Roeder Smith. And we like to think that we are professionally managed by an experienced staff. Just quickly, I talked to you a little bit about our district. They are, depending on the year, either the largest or the second largest in the state. And at times, they have, I think, before them one of the most difficult tasks. If you look at slide 2, they actually serve one of the most diverse populations in our state, and we like to think that They really are at the crossroads of most of the major issues we face as a society today, from poverty, immigration, and economic issues generally. This is the group of people that we hold dear because they actually have sort of our future citizens and leaders in their hands. When we look at our members, as we've expressed in the past, they are predominantly women, about 75 to 25%. The average salaries fall right in the heart of the middle class. And of about the $111 million that we pay out in benefits every year, a very large percentage of that stays right here in Minnesota, and not just in St. Paul, but across 59 districts. When we look at page 4 at our demographics, we're about 12,000 members strong right now. The predominant member base right now in actives is in what we call our coordinated plan. We have very few actives left in our basic plan, that is also flipped when we look at our retirees. The majority of our retirees are basic, and the others are coordinated. We look at their average benefits. They are, by all accounts, relatively modest. Our coordinated members earn about $1,500 a month in retirement benefits. On an after-tax basis, that comes down to about $1,200 a month. When we look at our average age of our active employee, that's about 45 years old, and our average retirement age has moved up to 64 years old. We often get the question, what are the early retirement rules in your plan? And since about 2012, there have actually been some pretty significant penalties in place. So right now, if you attempted to retire at the age of 55, which you could do, you'd experience a very significant reduction. So if you had a $1,000 benefit, you'd only walk away with about $450. That's had a major impact on the fund. We've driven up sort of the retirement age from 59 just a few years ago all the way to 64 today. When we think about this fund, we really don't think about it as a benefit-paying organization. We think about this as a very important financial engine that serves a social good. And so our first step is to look at the financial underpinnings of this organization, because we believe if we do that and we pay close attention to fiscal stewardship, we'll actually be able to maintain our covenant to our retirees for many generations to come. And I'm very happy to address the status of this fund over the years in particular. If you look back to just 2012 in this table, this plan was in significant economic hardship. We look at the deficiency we faced in 2012, and it was at 6.4%. And over the last 5 years, we've been able to bring this fund to nearly break even. I give the board a tremendous amount of credit for that, as well as my predecessors. They've taken the hard steps that requires, starting with proactively reducing the cost of living adjustment to 1%, and then doing the difficult job of keeping it there against great pressure to raise it. So we've maintained that 1%. In our proposals today, you'll see us maintain that as well. We also joined with two of the other plans, as you've heard, in proactively reducing our investment return assumption 2 years ago from 8.5 to 8. As I mentioned, we've increased the penalties on early retirement. And in the last round of reforms, we did raise employee and employer contributions. Again, all of this has led to an outstanding economic result for the plan, a steady increasing funding status to put us where we are today. And if we made no other changes, we would see continued steady progress on this plan to reach full funding. But as you've heard from the other two, we need to take into account two very important changes. We think it's important to do so in this year. One is the cost of mortality. You've heard all about that. That's simply the cost of future retirees living longer. And as well as we support the move to change the investment return assumption to 7.5%. We think those represent important conservative fiscal measures for the fund, but they come at a cost. And we think it's important to go ahead and acknowledge those costs and take appropriate action. Those two factors, mortality and the cost of the investment return assumption, will add about $130 million of liabilities to the fund. And in future pages, we detail that in terms of percentage of pay. In our proposal, as you're going to hear in a minute, we recommend raising the employer contribution rate to 9.5% over a period of time. That rate would put us on parity with TRA, as you've just heard them present. We would also recommend direct state aid to accelerate the improvement in the funding ratio of $5 million. We will also enact cost-saving measures in this plan, getting rid of COLA triggers, as you've heard other plans discuss, updating CSA load factors, and resetting the amortization period. But importantly, I also want to emphasize that we will not increase benefits as part of this plan. We will not take a COLA and bounce it back up to a higher rate. We will keep it at 1%. Now, typically, when we would come to you and present a package like this, you would hear us talk about an employee increase. And generally, I'd say I think that's a fair thing to do to present a balanced plan. One of the reasons that we are not doing that in this plan, and you're only seeing an employer proposal, is because there is a disparity that currently exists in St. Paul between the employee and the employer. Currently, and it's been the case for since 1999, the employees pay a percent or more higher than the employer, and that's an anomaly in this state, and I think an anomaly generally. Now, our employer, I'll acknowledge, does pay a supplemental to try to make up for past underfunding, but that needs to be distinguished from the normal rate that's paid. So step one, we need to close that gap, and in our proposal, in the first year, we'd like to bring the employee and employer up to parity. We turn to the next page, we outline briefly the funding proposal. And our proposal is to phase in the increase over 4 years. And again, ultimately, when it's fully phased in, this results in a $7.8 million increase in cost. As you've heard, partially, the governor has offset that in his budget. We're very grateful for that. We think that is a great first step and an important one. And we look forward to working with the commission over the upcoming weeks and months to see if we can close that gap further. If we can do that and implement this plan, we'll take this fund to 97% funding. In the interest of transparency, if we do not do the $5 million direct aid, we still get this plan to 84%, which again, that's a good number, the right direction, but the funding status improvement will be significantly slower. And given that this fund starts at a lower status, we'd like to see and we would recommend accelerating that pace. So again, if we can implement both the mortality changes, the 7.5%, as well as the savings and funding measures, we'll bring this plan to nearly break even and meet almost a full funding over the amortization period.
Any questions for Ms. Schertz? Doing pretty good. Well. All right. With that, thank you, Ms. Schertz. I appreciate that. members, in your packet is also some work that was done by Ms. Barth that hopefully you have a chance to take a look at. It's some recommendations on benefit changes and proposals that she worked on over the interim. And it's very good stuff. It's what other states. Ms. Barth, would you like to comment on this piece of work?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this was a project that we as commission staff, so Susan and I have both been working on this throughout kind of, I guess, beginning late summer, early fall, to just kind of look at what's happening nationally with defined benefit pension plans and how they're staying sustainable and how they're addressing longer mortality and lower market returns. And we just kind of went through the big three plans. We were asked to go through their statutes and just look at areas of whether they're all consistently doing the same thing, if one plan's doing something different than the other plan, areas that could potentially be looked at for cleanup. So that's just kind of the gist of the project.
And I hope members that we can really take a dive into some of these proposals and what other states are doing and have a pretty good discussion on that. Next week, we are going to... hold on a second here. We're going to first have the public testimony for TRA and St. Paul teachers, and then MSRS and PARA, police and fire, will be the following week after that. And then we're going to approve the actuarial assumptions that needed to be done this year for MSRS General, Correctional, State Patrol, the Legislators Plan, Parageneral, Correctional, Para Police and Fire, and St. Paul Teachers and TRA. Okay, and then we're also going to have a Deloitte will also be coming in and doing some alternatives to resetting the amortization period. And then we're going to, if we have time, we're going to look at passing out the omnibus bill from last year and using that as a vehicle for changes going forward, the work that we do this year. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, that was actually my question, is it's your intention to put them all together, not to have the separate bills. I think we did separate bills from last year to get those out early and then do the new bill, but you're going to put it all together?
Senator Pappas, I believe we're just going to go ahead and put it all together, okay. Get one bill out. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Pappas, this is primarily the work that we did last year, less some of the changes that are really not relevant based on some of the information that's coming forward. So it'll be what I always call the constituent corrections, some of the local fire relief, some of that kind of stuff, so that we can do that all in one meeting, because I'm sure we'll have some additional things as we're moving forward again this year that we'll want to look at. But at least we can use that as a base from our work last year as a result of the veto.
It's going to be a thick bill.
Yeah, it's going to be a big bill. That's right. Further question. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Just one other thing I think for the commission to consider would be taking up some kind of sense of the commission to get to leadership, to encourage them to include in their budget targets the money in each agency and direct chairs to make sure that they are actually including the pension money in their agency budgets, because the leaders have a lot of power to be able to basically tell the chairs in each of the committees to keep uniformity across that. So I'd like us to consider some kind of sense of the commission to send to leadership on that.
That's a very good point, Representative Thiessen. And I did promise you an answer, I think, from the leadership last year. But I have been talking to nonpartisan staff about that very issue, how it's going to be tracking going forward. I have not had a chance to talk to leadership about that. But very good point, and we do need to get an answer, because I think that's very important. Any further questions? Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. I'll see you next week.